Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a rising star in the Democratic Party, but one who was nearly kept from the race by the old establishment political machine in Queens, New York. This summer, her unlikely rise has been replicated by another underdog candidate and another young, progressive Latinx. Her name is Tiffany Caban, and there's a good chance she'll be the next Queens district attorney. Votes in her primary race are still being tallied, but at the moment, Caban is leading the establishment-backed borough president. Queens itself is a diverse community that crosses many ethnicities and classes, so we want to know how these two progressive candidates emerged from the borough at the very same time that Queens organizers stopped Amazon, the world's biggest corporation, from setting up shop in the neighborhood. We turn now to Alisa Aguilera. She's the co-executive director of Vocal New York, a community group that represents low-income people affected by mass incarceration, HIV, and homelessness, and which got behind Caban. Alisa, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this particular race that's playing out still as you speak. I want to say first off that Tiffany Caban's victory is being contested by one of her opponents, and it's just a primary. In Queens, the Democratic primary winner tends to be the outright winner. What can you tell us about Caban's policy promises and her appeal as a candidate?
Yeah, so Tiffany ran as an unapologetic public defender who wanted to become the district attorney to completely transform the office. She centered her campaign around immigrants, sex workers, formerly incarcerated people, poor people, undocumented folks, people that are really feeling the brunt of the criminal justice system in Queens and across the country. And she was saying, you know, the tough on crime, the law and order policies that have dominated our ethos in district attorney's offices across the country have not made us safer. They've harmed communities, and something has to change. So she's part of, you know, a broader movement of the Larry Krasners, the Rachel Rollinses that are saying, hey, like, we need to do something different in the district attorney's office. The prosecutors have so much discretion in what cases are brought forward. Are people going to jail, pretrial? All of these things. And, you know, we have the opportunity to elect somebody into that office and really let the community make a decision what kind of values they want to see.
And it's really interesting how somebody like Caban, who you said unapologetically left-leaning, wants to transform the office, how she's really, I guess, drawing in people from different immigrant groups and backgrounds. I spoke last week with Shaker Krishnan. He is a tenants' rights lawyer, and he helped get out the vote for Caban. I asked him about the people who are supporting a candidate like her, so let's take a listen.
I think to see so many new immigrants, many of whom, for whom English was not their first language, many for whom have so many far more pressing needs than a political decision. They're worried about their family, their kids, their school, their housing. To know that they had actually thought through these issues of revolutionizing the criminal justice system and made this decision, that was something so inspiring and made me, as a South Asian, very, very proud.
So, words on this?
Well, I think that Tiffany often says she meets people where they're at. And if you look at the South Asian community in Queens, people who are street vendors, people who are, have been the targets of NYPD surveillance after 9/11, people who were stopped and frisked, people have real concerns about the way that the criminal legal system operates in their borough. They know that being caught up in the criminalization of poverty could lead to your deportation. And so going from community to community and really working closely with community organizations out there and other people that are organizing those communities for many, many years, and to say, you know, what do you need from me? And I think that's something that is, you know, completely different from you'd ever see in a district attorney race. So many of our members who are people who are formerly incarcerated would say, I thought I would never, ever be knocking doors, encouraging my friends and family to vote for a district attorney. District attorneys were always people that I feared, people who wanted to punish me. But meeting Tiffany showed me that something could be different. And it's that sort of inspiration, that sort of hope is what gets people out knocking on the doors. These status quo politicians in Queens, nobody's excited about them running. You know, you sort of think, oh, that's the default. That is going to happen. I don't have any power. You don't have any power in that scenario. But with a Tiffany Caban victory, with an AOC victory, we have the power to transform our communities.
Alisa Aguilera, co-executive director of Vocal New York, a left-leaning community organizing group. Thanks for stepping in.
Thank you.
The surge in progressive electorates and candidates isn't just happening in New York City. It's also starting to take roots in districts across the country. Joining us now to discuss the progressive movement on the national level is Alexander Podkul, the co-author of the Primaries Project at the Brookings Institution, which monitored and analyzed every congressional race in the country during the 2018 midterms. Alexander, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
If you were just looking at Queens, you would think the progressive movement is dominating politics. Is that the case nationally?
Well, going forward, the jury is still out. But if we look at 2018, that was certainly the case in the neighborhood of Queens. But across the country, the verdict was a little bit murkier. And so even though there was a lot of attention about some of the anomalous victories of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York or Ayanna Pressley up in Massachusetts, there were many, many more cases where progressive candidates did not fare that well at the ballot box. One thing we did see in 2018 was a marked increase in the number of self-identified progressives vying to be the Democratic Party's nominee in her or his congressional district. However, they lost at higher rates when compared to traditional establishment Democrat candidates. And so it seems to be there are quite a number of activists out there, but not everybody is having the same electoral fortunes.
How would you quantify that? How much is this increase in the number of people who are entering congressional races who consider themselves progressives?
My co-author Elaine Kmark and I have done the project back in 2014 up to 2018. And we saw that in 2014 and in 2016, there were fewer than 30% of all Democrats running in congressional primaries were calling them the progressive candidate. However, in the 2018 midterms, that number jumped up to about 43%. So it was a major increase in the number of candidates. And our way of determining if someone is a progressive candidate or not is we were looking at what the candidate was saying. Rather than looking at interest group endorsements or campaign finance spending or contributions, what we did is we looked at candidate websites and candidate messages. And if they were calling themselves, "I am the progressive candidate," then we counted that person as progressive. So we were looking exactly at what the candidates were saying.
So the question is, are these candidates, are they jumping to districts across the country, or is it focused on certain, I guess, blue state kind of enclaves?
So we saw quite a number of candidates overall. We saw a record number of candidates in the 2018 midterm elections. And just by virtue of the number of candidates, the progressive candidates were running all over. And it's interesting if we look at what types of races they were running in, because there are tons of examples. And so I think the popular ones that the media likes to discuss are the cases of say, an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where she takes down an incumbent Democrat who's been there forever. And so it's a very exciting primary election. However, there were also a great number of cases where these candidates either didn't win their primary, which was the case of about 70% of these progressives running in non-incumbent primaries, or they were running in races that are very right-leaning districts. And so, yes, the progressives did win a number of races, but they were winning in places where a Republican was almost guaranteed to win the election in November, even in a 2018 cycle that favored Democrats greatly.
Now, you mentioned AOC. Of course, we're talking about Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, many of these people who are sort of these stars of the left. Are candidates and communities of color increasingly defining the platform?
That's also hard to measure, but if we look at the language that progressives were using on the campaign trail, we do see a bit of a leftward inch. So, for example, if we look at attitudes on healthcare policy, we saw that one in two Democratic candidates in 2018 was supportive of some sort of Medicare for all or single payer healthcare system. Of that one in two, 75% of those were by self-identified progressive candidates. And then if we fast forward to some of the Democratic presidential debates that we just saw last week, it seems to have an up ballot trend of the number of candidates who are willing to explore and express these opinions.
Given what we've seen in the first two Democratic presidential debates for the 2020 race, do you think that this what's happening in these districts is having a decisive impact on the presidential candidates?
Yes, it seems to be that there is an impact on the presidential candidates from these congressional candidates. So if we look, like I said, on healthcare is, I probably think, the best example of some of the up-ballot trends. Additionally, in our research, in tracking what these congressional candidates were talking about, we've also saw a big spike in discussions of criminal justice reform by Democratic candidates, but not so much by Republican candidates. And if we track some of the conversations that are happening at the presidential nomination stage, it seems to be that those conversations are being reflected.
What lessons do you think these, I guess, highly visible political upsets in places like Queens do have for the rest of the country?
It's very soon to tell. One thing that we do learn from these races, though, is that the media really likes to discuss low turnout races that are rather anomalous. For example, in the Queens race, there were 85,000 voters in a district where there are 750,000 registered Democrats. And then in the AOC race, that was decided by fewer than 30,000 Democrats in a race where there are over 200,000 active registered Democrats. And so we have some of these races that are unbelievably low turnout affairs. Fewer than 15% of registered partisans are turning out to vote. Winning by very small margins in AOC's case, she did very well. But in the DA race, Tiffany Caban won by fewer than 1,100 votes. And so it's really hard to extrapolate an overall lesson from races that have such a margin. And also, we need to remember the cases where progressives maybe didn't win. So on everybody's calendar was the Dan Lipinski race in the Chicago area, where Bernie Sanders endorsed progressive candidate Marie Newman was vying to take the Democratic nomination. In that race, Marie Newman lost. It was a close race, but she lost. But we need to be focusing that for when we think about the AOCs in the race, that there were also scores of other candidates like Marie Newman who didn't perform that well. And progressive activists should learn from those examples and maybe think a little bit more about district fit.
Alexander Podkuhl is co-author of the Primaries Project at the Brookings Institution. Thanks, Alexander.
Thanks so much for having me.